Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to do something new. We're going to summarize some of the top stories of the past year, 2010. What were some of the top stories that grabbed the headlines, which are going to determine the agenda for science in the coming years? What were the top stories that grabbed our attention and riveted the attention of scientists around the world? And then we're going to bring on a special guest today. We're going to bring on Mr. Brian Dumain, who has a rather interesting point of view. His point of view is exemplified in his book, The Plot to Save the Planet, in which he argues that free markets and private enterprise, instead of being the problem with regards to global warming and the environment, are part of the solution. Perhaps entrepreneurship, free markets can help us to save the planet. Well, we'll talk about him about his minority thesis in Exploration today. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top science stories of 2010. What were the science stories that grabbed the headlines, which are going to determine the agenda for the coming years? Well, if I were to pick among all the top stories of 2010, I would say perhaps the discovery of a new form of DNA found in California near Yosemite Park ranks among the top stories of the year. Every single biology textbook on the planet Earth may have to be revised. In fact, our entire definition of life itself may have to be revised, because all life is based on DNA. Why? Because DNA can copy itself. It can make a Xerox copy of itself. So if you have one DNA molecule, then you can have 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, until you can take over the entire planet. But why are all DNA molecules the same except rearranged in a different way? Believe it or not, the DNA of a yeast cell, a bacteria, a rabbit, a giraffe, a platypus, and you are essentially the same, except the pieces of DNA, the nucleic acids, are rearranged in a different order. Well, that's why this new discovery coming out of a lake outside Yosemite Park in California is rather interesting. Phosphorus is one of the key chemicals involved in the creation of DNA, along with oxygen and carbon and nitrogen. And it turns out that if you replace phosphorus with arsenic, which is a poisonous chemical, then bingo, it turns out you get a new form of DNA that's never been seen before. Now, this has vast implications, a new form of life essentially being formed, a new form of biological chemistry, if it holds up. First of all, it means that we have to expand our definition of life in outer space. Life in outer space may be quite different from life here on Earth. We may just have to get used to the fact that there are DNA molecules in outer space that are quite different than the familiar DNA molecules on the planet Earth. And it also means that perhaps we can even create new forms of DNA by replacing different atoms within DNA with other atoms on the periodic chart. Well, we'll wait and see whether this new result holds up, but if it does, hey, every single biology textbook on the Earth is going to have to be revised. Speaking of which, all astronomy books on the planet Earth are now being revised because of the discovery of over 500 Earth-like twins in outer space. And it turns out that one of them actually lies within the, quote, habitable zone. Now, let me explain. Of the 500 planets we discover in outer space, it's rather disappointing that most of them are gigantic Jupiter-sized planets, which are very easy to see with our instruments, however, are unsuitable for life. However, small planets that live right next to their mother star, which are not too close, not too far from the sun, are just right to create liquid water. Liquid water, believe it or not, is one of the most precious substances in the universe. It is the amniotic fluid of life, the mixing bowl where the first DNA got off the ground. And in 2010, the first planet was discovered that exists within this habitable zone. So we now believe that not only are there maybe billions of Jupiter-sized planets out there in outer space, but there could be a large number of habitable planets that have liquid oceans on them. And next year, the results of the Kepler and the Coros satellites will probably be announced, in which case we will have scores of Earth-like twins being now compiled in a vast encyclopedia of possible planets in space that look very close to the planet Earth. So remember, the discovery of Earth-like twins could create an existential shock. We'll be dazzled by the fact that looking at the night sky, we will see planets that perhaps are twins of the Earth. And when we look in outer space, we'll wonder whether anyone is looking back. And again, speaking about biology, yet another breakthrough was made, this time in the creation of what is called synthetic life. Many people have wondered, well, is it possible to take a cell, take the minimum number of genes necessary to have the functions of life being carried out, tinker with the genes of it, and create a life form that has never been seen before on the surface of the planet Earth? Well, in 2010, scientists were amazed that they could actually carry this off. We now more or less know the minimum number of genes necessary for a cell's housekeeping so that it can reproduce, so that it can absorb nutrients from the environment, and excrete waste safely into the environment as well. Not only that, but you can actually tinker with the DNA as a consequence, because scientists are now rather good at rewriting the genes within a cell. Now, does this mean that we're going to have Frankenstein monsters come out of the laboratory? Not anytime soon. This is nothing but the first preliminary baby steps in terms of beginning to understand the minimum number of genes necessary to support life, and then to be able to tinker with some of these genes. There are also vast commercial applications of this technology as well. What happens if we can create a microbe which can digest oil after an oil slick? Or what happens if we can create a microbe that can devour large quantities of carbon dioxide? That could even help regulate the atmosphere of the planet Earth and perhaps deal with global warming. So some people think that one possible solution to global warming may come out of a test tube. And also in the world of physics, the Large Hadron Collider, this gigantic machine outside Geneva, Switzerland, 27 miles in circumference, costing 10 billion euros, has now been cranked up to half energy. Eventually, sometime next year, we hope to get it up to 14 trillion electron volts. Unfortunately, when the Large Hadron Collider was first turned on, it was dogged by enormous engineering problems. It turns out that liquid coolant was spilled onto the floor of the Large Hadron Collider, causing about several hundred million dollars in damages to the magnets, but now it seems to be running smoothly. And next year, perhaps it'll snag the Higgs boson, which is a particle that is a missing piece of the Standard Model, and perhaps even beyond that, create particles that have never been seen in the laboratory ever, including dark matter. In fact, the leading candidate for dark matter is the photino, a particle predicted by string theory, and we hope that the Large Hadron Collider may give us a handle on whether or not string theory is the fabled theory of everything. String theory, by the way, is what I do for a living. That's my day job. And hopefully the Large Hadron Collider will not only give us a recreation of a tiny piece of the Big Bang itself, but able to create particles that have never been seen before in the laboratory, each particle being a musical note on a vibrating string. And we hope to create the next octave of the vibrating string with the Large Hadron Collider. And speaking about the world of physics, in 2010, graphene grabbed the attention of scientists, winning a Nobel Prize for two Russian scientists. Graphene is ordinary carbon, except it is one molecule thick in a gigantic single-sheeted layer. It is the thinnest layer that has been achieved for a commercial application. Graphene is so strong that you could take an elephant, put the elephant on a pencil, and balance the pencil on a sheet of graphene, and graphene will not rip. In fact, it is the strongest material ever seen in the laboratory, stronger than diamonds. And we also think it may actually replace the transistor made out of silicon. One day, perhaps in 10, 15 years, your computer will no longer be twice as powerful as the previous year's computer because Moore's law will break down. At that point, we may have to go to a new form of transistor, molecular transistors, carbon transistors, and that's where graphene comes in. Also, looking at the year 2010, it seemed to be a year of disasters. Earthquakes, volcanic activity in Iceland. It seemed that everywhere we looked, the Earth was having its revenge on humans. And some people said, well, is God angry at us? Is the Earth angry at us? Why are we being plagued by these earthquakes and volcanoes? Well, there's good news and bad news. First of all, the good news is the fact that these are natural occurrences. And if you actually take a look at the frequency of these occurrences, they're rather normal. And the bad news is, however, that the reason for this seemingly increase in activity is because the human population is spreading into areas where it never spread before. And we now all have medias and iPhones and cell phones, and we're all connected. So we're much more aware of natural phenomena that dogged our ancestors but did not get so much publicity. Volcanoes, hey, they erupt all the time. But disrupting transatlantic air flights, well, that didn't exist 100 years ago. So previously, when we had gigantic volcanic eruptions, they were not capable of disrupting modern society because there was no such thing as modern society and modern airplanes. And for that matter, most earthquakes take place underwater. Yes, earthquakes, monster earthquakes, take place all the time, except they usually rattle areas where there are no people. But because humans are encroaching now upon every single nook and cranny of the planet Earth, and we're all connected, it means that we're much more sensitive to things that our ancestors thought were simply just part of the normal cycle. And also, 2010 may go down as the hottest year ever recorded in the history of science. Well, we still have to wait for the latest results. The numbers have to be churned, have to be analyzed, but it turns out that 2010 is going to be perhaps the hottest year ever recorded in the history of science. And this means, of course, that the Earth is definitely warming up. And then the Neanderthal genome, not only was it sequenced, but also because we can now sequence tiny fragments of DNA from fossils, we now realize that there's an entirely new species of humans which coexisted with the Neanderthals that populated huge chunks of Siberia and Asia. In other words, the family tree of humans has to be revised because DNA analysis is so good that, well, sort of like Jurassic Park, we can now analyze DNA from long extinct organisms, especially humanoids. And we now realize that, well, not only were humans alive 30, 40,000 years ago, not only did we coexist with the Neanderthals, but there was, in fact, yet another species of humans looking very close to the Neanderthals, which roamed most of Siberia and large parts of Asia. In fact, if you look at the DNA of modern populations in this area, you find an overlap. And that gets us into a rather controversial conclusion that perhaps there was mixing, genetic mixing between the Neanderthals' cousins, and Homo sapiens. Well, we'll have to wait and see whether that result holds up. Science, of course, is based on reproducible, testable, falsifiable results. And anything as controversial as inbreeding between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals has to be checked and rechecked by other researchers. This is one of the hottest fields now in anthropology.
And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Brian Dumain of Fortune magazine, and he has a different perspective on global warming. His new book is called, quote, The Plot to Save the Planet, How Visionary Entrepreneurs and Corporate Titans Are Creating Real Solutions to Global Warming. Now, in the past, some environmentalists have said that the problem is corporate America. They are the ones that have to be dragged kicking and screaming to address the concept of global warming. However, Brian Dumain takes a different position. His position is that there are some visionaries. There are some people in Wall Street who realize, well, that global warming is a real problem. First of all, if it destroys civilization, they and their children will also be destroyed. Second of all, maybe you can even make a profit. A profit because green technologies open the way for new avenues of research and development. And third, it's a great way to save the planet. So once again, our special guest today is Brian Dumain of Fortune magazine. The book is called The Plot to Save the Planet, and it takes a slightly different approach to global warming, stating that perhaps even Wall Street will eventually get the faith. The first question for you is, state your background, because the energy issue is so contentious right now.
Well, my background is that I've been a financial journalist at both Fortune magazine and Fortune Small Business magazine for the last 28 years. I got interested in the green movement about 8 years ago, and I noticed that there was a lot of innovation beginning to happen in this area, and I was curious about it, so I started covering it in the magazine. I assigned my writers to follow these stories, and it just started to really pique my imagination and my interest. And then what happened was that with Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, the film about global warming, scientists around the world started to say that the global warming problem is more serious than we thought. And what had happened was a lot of my friends were, you know, very smart people were sitting around saying there's nothing we can do about it. They were very pessimistic. It's too big a problem. We're stuck, and I'm not even going to think about it because it's such a bad problem. And I felt that's wrong. That's got to be wrong. There have to be some solutions out there. So I set out to find solutions to global warming, and that's what prompted me to write my book, The Plot to Save the Planet.
Okay, well, first of all, let me play devil's advocate. First of all, why should we believe you, given the fact that corporate America has lied to us, has fought tooth and nail the slightest, even the slightest change in our energy policy, even though, of course, they try to portray themselves as being green. So why should we believe any of the things you say in this book?
Well, I think the easiest way to understand what's happening is that a lot of companies and a lot of executives and a lot of entrepreneurs now believe that there's money to be made in fighting global warming. And there's nothing like the profit motive to change the behavior of corporations. I mean, yes, many of them want to, you know, do good, and that's fine and that's admirable, but I think this is going to be the biggest explosion of wealth in the 21st century. It's going to create new technologies, new corporations, and probably most importantly, millions of green-collar jobs. It's a way for America to get back up on its feet economically.
Okay, well, let's first of all talk about Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is a maverick billionaire. He does long-term financing from his place in Omaha. And some people think maybe that he's some kind of oracle of some sort, but tell us, what is this billionaire doing, Warren Buffett?
Well, Warren Buffett, who's one of the, as you say, one of the shrewdest investors in the world, is also one of the largest investors in wind power in the United States. He owns a utility in Iowa that's placing hundreds of wind turbines in fields, near towns, near cities. And he believes that it's going to be a big part of our energy future. And it's not just Warren Buffett. There are large corporations, small venture capital firms, private equity firms. They're all pouring money into wind, into solar, into clean coal technologies, into electric cars. What we're seeing is just the start of what can be a renaissance of green technology.
So you're saying that the sea change is taking place because I guess oil is right through the roof right now, changing America's gas-guzzling habits. And in that sense, there's a new business climate whereby you can make a profit. Is that what you're saying?
That's absolutely right. We've hit a perfect storm with oil. The price, as you say, is high, close to around $143 a barrel. At the pump, it's over $4 a gallon. And then we're running out of oil. The non-OPEC nations are taking out less and less oil from their fields every year. And no one's really sure how much oil exists in the OPEC fields. And then there's the political problem. We're dependent on nations, some of which are hostile to the interests of the United States, for our supply of oil. We're addicted to oil, and we need to get off of it. You put all those reasons together, the global warming effect, and most smart business people these days see the writing on the wall, and they know that carbon is going to be eventually outlawed in the United States. It already is being severely restricted in Europe. Both candidates, Senator McCain, Senator Obama, propose a cap and trade bill, which would limit the amount of carbon that industry could emit each year. And if that kind of bill gets passed during either one of their administrations, then it's just not going to pay to be in industries that emit carbon into the atmosphere.
Now, we mentioned Warren Buffett, but there's also John Doerr, the venture capitalist and early backer of Google. And he is saying that, quote, green tech could be bigger than the Internet and perhaps the biggest economic opportunity of the 21st century. Bigger than the Internet?
Absolutely. Energy is a much larger industry than infotech. And if you look at the size globally of the industry, I believe it's $3 trillion, and we're going to have to transform that from a carbon-based industry to a carbon-free-based industry. That's an enormous economic opportunity. And let me just give you one small example of John Doerr and what he's doing. He's invested in a company called Amyris out in Oakland. Amyris is a biotech firm that's working on a new type of fuel. And it was started by some Berkeley scientists who are working on a cure for malaria in Africa, an affordable cure for malaria. They had a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And in the process of searching for this cheaper cure for malaria medicine, they found that they could design a microbe that could eat plant matter and turn it into not ethanol, but actually a hydrocarbon, such as a gasoline or diesel fuel or even jet fuel. This company has raised $150 million. They're partnering in Brazil with sugarcane refineries, and by 2010, they hope to have a fuel on the market which will emit 80% less greenhouse gas than gasoline and cost about half of what a barrel of oil costs today.
And speaking about oil, we all know that a lot of it goes to transportation. However, Detroit has been lagging for decades. I remember as a kid, Detroit was fighting seatbelts, of all things, saying that the American people will not pay for seatbelts. Then they fought the padded dashboard. Then they fought the hybrid. Now they're fighting the electric and the fuel cell car, and Honda has now unveiled, very expensive, but a commercially available fuel cell car that emits no hydrocarbons whatsoever. So tell us a bit about the cars of the future and whether or not Detroit is too little too late.
Well, Detroit's in a tough position. They are behind the Japanese in terms of green car technology. When Toyota is the clear leader. When they were developing the Prius, Detroit was still manufacturing SUVs and large pickup trucks, and now sales of those have plummeted with the high price of gas. Toyota is thriving. GM is in financial straits, as is Chrysler and Ford. There is a glimmer of hope. General Motors has committed to production of the Chevy Volt, and this would be a plug-in hybrid driven by a lithium-ion battery. What that means is you could basically drive the first 40 miles every day without using any gasoline. You'd plug in your car at night, recharge your battery, and you can travel 40 miles gas-free. If you want to go on a longer trip, the car would have a small gasoline engine on board, which would recharge the battery. So you could have a range of 640 miles per tank, and you get the equivalent of about 60 to 70 miles per gallon on the car. Now, they say they're launching it, and they're serious about it. In the meantime, Toyota, in the probably end of 2009, will come out with a totally redesigned hybrid car to replace the Prius. They'll have a whole line of hybrid cars. And, again, they're going to use this lithium-ion battery technology, which will allow you to go 30 to 40 miles on a charge. And the interesting thing about that is that three-quarters of Americans drive 30 miles a day or less. So this would meet the requirements of the vast majority of American drivers. The hydrogen car that Honda comes out, I think that's a next-generation technology. I still think we're a good 15 or 20 years away from hydrogen. The problem with hydrogen is that you still need fossil fuels to create the hydrogen itself. The hydrogen fuel cells are very expensive. Honda's going to lose a lot of money on every one of the cars it leases of its hydrogen cars, and they're only putting a handful out in the market. I think the technology of the near future, the technology that's going to help us out in our oil crisis and our global warming crisis, will be the plug-in hybrid driven by a lithium-ion battery.
Well, we're running out of time in the first part of exploration, but after the break, I want to ask you a question. And that is, there's no free lunch. Even if we have electric cars and fuel cells, the electricity has to come from somewhere, mainly a coal-fired plant. And a coal-fired plant, in turn, creates carbon dioxide. And so the question is, what do we do to replace coal? Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest today is Brian Dumain of Fortune Magazine, and the book is called The Plot to Save the Planet. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And also be sure to dial into my website. It's www.mkaku.org, mkaku.org. And also be sure to check out my latest book. It's called Physics of the Impossible. That's right, Physics of the Impossible. And it was on the New York Times bestseller list for 5 weeks running. So get a copy and find out how by going to my website, mkaku.org. So stay tuned. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with Brian Dumain of Fortune Magazine, author of the new book, The Plot to Save the Planet, How Visionary Entrepreneurs and Corporate Titans Are Creating Real Solutions to Global Warming. So in this hour, we'll be talking about a different approach to global warming. not just government intervention, but Mr. Dumain claims that even Wall Street visionaries, even progressive billionaires, will also see that global warming has to be addressed because it'll probably doom all civilization, including their descendants, and including the fact that perhaps you can even make a profit on green technologies. So once again, the book is called The Plot to Save the Planet. Now, Mr. Dumain, let me ask you a question. We physicists say there's something called the conservation of energy, i.e. there's no free lunch, energy has to come from someplace, and when you have a plug-in hybrid, the electricity from the wall gives you your energy, but that electricity comes from a coal-fired plant which belches enormous amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, including mercury, which winds up on your dinner table.
Right.
So what's going to replace coal?
Your question is a good one. What if you look at the numbers, what happens is that even though you're using fossil fuels, the amount of carbon that you emit into the atmosphere using an electric car is less than using a gallon of gasoline, by depending on where you are in the country, by anywhere from a third to a half less carbon being emitted. Now, in places like Central California, which has a lot of hydro and a lot of solar, there are even greater savings on the amount of carbon being emitted. And one would hope as we move forward, we're going to move off of coal technology and then have more of these giant solar thermal farms in the desert. There's a company called Bright Source, and they just contracted with Pacific Gas and Electric for 900 megawatts of solar thermal power in the desert. That's the equivalent of one nuclear power plant. And one other point on this is that most people would want to charge their cars at night, and we have excess capacity of electricity at night. That electricity is being generated anyway and isn't being used, and we could use that to recharge the cars. And otherwise, it's just being wasted, basically.
Now, some people say that no matter what we do, in the short term, coal is going to be the winner, even if we go with the electric car or the fuel cell car. However, as you pointed out, there are problems with coal. Some people have talked about carbon sequestration or trying to extract carbon dioxide from the coal-fired plant. What are your thoughts about the economics and technology of perhaps gas liquefying or deep-sixing all this carbon dioxide from coal-fired plants?
Well, I think that's going to happen. That's going to be part of the mix looking forward. It's technologically feasible to do that. We've done it with the oil fields, sequestering some of the CO2 coming out of the wells. The question is the cost. It's very expensive to do it right now. Once we get a carbon cap and trade bill in, which will limit the amount of carbon to be emitted each year, that will provide the economic incentive for utilities to start investing in these carbon sequestration technologies. It's a very important part of the mix. There are some entrepreneurs working on a different technology. They're using algae to eat the exhaust coming out of the coal plants, and they turn the carbon coming out of the exhaust into biofuels and animal feedstock. There's a company working with Arizona Public Service called Green Fuel Technologies out of MIT. And they're still very much in the incubator stage, but they've made some great progress on the technology. And if this could work, it'd be a tremendous way of being able to burn coal without having negative effects on the environment.
Now, you also mentioned General Electric and Duke Energy. However, General Electric is also heavily involved with boiling water nuclear power plants, and Duke Energy is also involved with nuclear. But what is the low-carbon business that you mentioned that Duke Energy and GE are promoting?
Okay, well, two different approaches here. Duke Energy has a program it's rolling out, and it has eight other utilities around the country joining in called Save a Watt. And it's a very interesting concept. Right now, you and I pay utilities to build coal plants to provide more electricity for everyone. We see it in our increases in our monthly bills when energy demand increases. And Jim Rogers, who's the CEO of Duke Energy, said, what if we turn that on its head? What if consumers paid us not to build a coal-fired plant? In other words, the utility would be able to come into our homes, install solar panels on our roofs, buy us more energy efficient appliances, and put a smart grid system into our homes where they can monitor the amount of electricity that we use so that it, you know, saves overall in the consumption. And then we would pay a monthly increase in our bills for the electricity or the price of the electricity, but the theory is that we'd be saving so much through conservation overall, our electricity bills overall would actually drop somewhat. And he's rolling that out in the Southeast. It's showing tremendous promise, and some people think through conservation measures like this, we could get about halfway to our global warming reduction goals. Now, General Electric has their Eco Imagination program, and they're investing heavily in green tech. They're the largest maker of windmills in the country. They're working on LED lighting systems, which should save tremendous amounts of electricity compared to incandescent lights. They're working on hybrid locomotives to save fuel when moving our goods around the country. Now, you know, they're a big corporation, and they're in energy-intensive businesses, but they're trying to cut down dramatically the amount of carbon that these different technologies emit into the atmosphere. And with nuclear power plants, yes, GE works in that arena, as do a number of other large corporations around the world. And if you look at the numbers for global warming, it's really hard to get around the idea that we can lick global warming without building more nuclear power plants. It's a very difficult decision because there are tremendous problems with nuclear power plants. We have the terrorist threats. We've got the waste storage problem. We have nuclear proliferation. You know, can the fuel be used to be turned into weapons that terrorists could use? So those problems have to be addressed. But if you look at the overall numbers, nuclear power plants in the United States generate about 20% of our electricity. We have 104 plants. Over the next 40 or 50 years, I mean, those plants aren't getting any younger, and most of them will have to be retired. So just to stay even with that 20% of electricity that doesn't emit any greenhouse gas, we're going to have to build 104 nuclear power plants over the next 40 or 50 years.
But isn't there a problem given the fact that Yucca Mountains, the nuclear waste storage site, will not open anytime soon, and some people are saying it may never open, in which case the nuclear industry will suffer from nuclear constipation without any place to put the waste. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, it is a problem. It's become a political football in Nevada. We need a political solution for that. I think there is a technological solution. The French get 80% of their electricity from nuclear power plants. They reprocess the fuel, which means there's much less waste, so you'd need a much smaller storage area. That might be one of the solutions. Of course, when you do that, it makes it easier to turn that spent fuel into nuclear weapons, and that's a problem that has to be addressed. But I think technology will come up with a storage solution if the politicians will come up with their own solutions first on how exactly we should do it and where the funding will come from.
Let's now talk about the home. We talked about the transportation sector, which consumes a tremendous amount of gasoline and fossil fuels, but now let's talk about the home. You talk about an energy miser home and buildings, starting with, for example, the Bank of America Tower right here in New York City, but also for middle-income homes. What are your thoughts?
Well, buildings produce about 40% of the greenhouse gas that we emit each year, so there's tremendous opportunity for savings there. The Bank of America Tower is built by the Durst Corporation. They're a local developer in New York. It's owned by the Durst Corporation and the Bank of America. It'll be the second largest skyscraper, highest skyscraper, after the Empire State Building in New York City. And it has won what's called a Platinum LEED certification. That's a way to measure how green a building is, and Platinum is the highest award you can win. And that is the first, the Bank of America Tower will be the first when it opens in a few months to achieve a Platinum LEED status. What that means is that they're going to use about half the water and half the electricity of a comparable skyscraper its size. And it's all done through design, smart design. The building only costs about $3 or percent more to build, but the owners will see that many times over in savings through operating the building using less energy in the years to come. So that's a great example. With a little, you know, smart design, you can really make a big impact on the amount of energy we use. There's a house out in Santa Monica built by an entrepreneur whose name is Steve Glenn. His company is Living Homes, and his house is the first platinum residence in the United States. And this house uses 90% less power than a traditional house its size. It's about 2,500 square feet. It has photovoltaic panels on the roof to generate electricity. It has solar hot water on the roof to provide hot water for the residents. It has a gray water system, so the water runoff from the sinks and the showers is not wasted. It's used to irrigate the lawn of the house. One small example, the countertops in the kitchen, they look like beautiful New England soapstone, but they're actually made of recycled newspapers, and there was a tremendous savings of energy in the manufacturing of that countertop compared to cutting stone out of a quarry and cutting it and shipping it to a new home. The house is actually a prefab. The shell went up in one day, so there weren't as many trips by the workers to and from the construction site. That was another tremendous savings of greenhouse gas. So there's amazing sorts of innovation going on in the housing sector. Steve Glenn likes to say that, you know, pretty soon building green will just be the way we build all things. It won't even be called building green.
Well, sometimes on TV, the TV camera goes into the home of some Hollywood movie star who boasts about all the solar panels he has. But, well, if you're not a Hollywood movie star, we are talking about a very expensive technology, a technology that is still not yet competitive to fossil fuel in terms of the average Joe. So tell us a little bit about the cost. The costs, are they dropping with time? When will the average person be able to create a solar home?
You're absolutely right. Solar is still about 2 to 3 times more expensive than normal electricity, depending on where you live in the country. But those prices are dropping, and they're dropping dramatically. Most experts think that solar will be affordable within 3 to 5 years. Some think even sooner. In California, Governor Schwarzenegger has a million roof initiative where the state is providing subsidies to install solar panels on a million homes in the state, and that program's already well underway and doing quite well. One of the most interesting companies I came across in researching my book is called NanoSolar, and they're out in Palo Alto. Martin Rossenshin is a Silicon Valley engineer who in 2001 decided to go into the solar industry. And just a month or so ago, he started shipping his solar panels, which are called thin film. It's almost like a piece of aluminum foil that you point at the sun and it generates electricity. He's built two factories, one in California, one in Germany, and these pieces of thin film solar generate electricity at about what it costs to generate electricity from a natural gas power plant. So it's the cheapest solar on the market. The first pieces of thin film solar are going to be used in Germany in a small utility project to provide electricity to a German village. But the price is remarkably affordable compared to other solar systems and competitive with natural gas power. And he thinks as he makes more of this stuff, the price is going to come down even more and it'll be competitive with electricity generated from coal, which is the cheapest.
Now, with the price of fossil fuels rising dramatically and with the cost of solar technology dropping dramatically and with the two curves crossing, let's say within 5-plus years or so, to be generous, do you think at that point there could be a sea change once people realize that you can actually save oodles of dollars by going solar because the two curves have crossed?
Absolutely. I think there will be a sea change. But one thing to keep in mind is that there's no silver bullet out there. I like to think of it as silver buckshot. I mean, there are going to be solutions coming from all sorts of sectors of business. Yes, solar will be a very important part of the equation, but so will wind. So will conservation in terms of really energy-smart appliances. electric cars will play a part. Carbon sequestration will play a part. And I think that's when we hit the tipping point. I think when more and more of these technologies get affordable and there are venture capitalists, entrepreneurs, large companies all working to make this happen, I think when we hit that point, I think we'll be amazed how quickly we can start moving away from our carbon-based energy economy towards a clean energy-based economy.
Okay, now to play devil's advocate again, if you take a look at the big boys now, now we're talking Exxon. We're not talking about little Hollywood entrepreneurs putting solar panels on their home. We're talking about the big leagues now. We're talking about Exxon. I just read an article just about a month ago saying that some people of the Rockefeller family, which have a big stake in Exxon, were getting sick and tired of the fact that Exxon is dragging its feet and is not part of the solution. They are part of the problem, even though if you watch all their TV commercials, you'd never believe it. You'd think they were the greenest corporation on earth watching their TV ads, which are 100% fluff. Now, given the fact that these members of the Rockefeller family are getting so irritated, they may think about mounting a stockholders revolt against them. Do you think that there's some of the major polluters may be forced to come to grips with this challenge?
There was an Austrian economist named Joseph Schumpeter who came up with a theory called creative destruction. And not everybody is going to be a winner in this new green economy. There'll be losers also. And I think those energy companies that don't change with the time, and I think this is what members of the Rockefeller family were trying to get across to management of Exxon, that they're putting the future of the corporation in danger. In my book, I cite executives from Exxon who say, what we do best is we search for oil, and we drill oil, we refine oil, and we richly rewarded our shareholders for doing that. And that's great. If that's their strategy that they want to take, that's fine. But they're not really part of the solution, and that's the risk. I remember talking during the research of my book to a venture capitalist who was saying, it's fine with us that the oil companies aren't doing as much as people think they should in terms of clean energy, because we'll come up with the next technologies of the future, and if the oil companies want to survive, they're going to have to buy it from us.
Okay. Now let's shift gears. We talked about entrepreneurs. We talked about corporations. Now let's talk about the governments. But even more important, the whole world is looking at the skyrocketing cost of oil. And the question is, what are governments going to do about it? So what are your thoughts about how governments should act in these times?
Well, there's no easy fix to the high price of oil or gasoline. That's just supply and demand in the market, and any short-term fix that the government proposes, I don't believe will work. I mean, dropping the federal gas tax over the summer driving months, I mean, that's not going to do anything. Drilling offshore or in Alaska, at best, you might get some oil back in the pipeline in 5 to 10 years. It's not going to do anything about getting down oil prices in the short term. What I think the government really needs to do is come up with a comprehensive program to lead the country away from a carbon-based economy to a carbon-free economy. And there are many ways they can do this. As I mentioned earlier, Senators McCain and Obama both have proposed a cap-and-trade bill in Congress. And if that is passed, that's going to help hasten the development of clean fuel technologies, because it's going to make burning carbon or using carbon or emitting carbon more expensive. We also need more green R&D on the federal level. So that technology that the government can produce is an important part of the equation, and if it's not funded, then we're missing out on some opportunities. And also, I think the government will be able to sort of act as a cheerleader for the American people. We need some leadership. I mean, there's going to be some sacrifice required making this transition. We need a leader who understands the problem, who can explain it to the American people, and can give us hope. I mean, I wrote an optimistic book in The Plot to Save the Planet. I think we can come up with the technological solutions to lick this problem, but we need political leadership also to get the American people behind this idea, behind this transition, to get everyone pulling together to make a cleaner, greener world.
And you mentioned cap and trade. Could you just explain that to our listeners?
Cap and trade is a system that's being used in Europe right now. And basically what it does is it says every year industry has to emit less and less carbon. And so you're basically giving permits to industry to emit only so much carbon, and then the next year fewer permits, and the next year after that fewer permits, with the idea that we'd meet our goals of carbon reduction. Obama wants to reduce carbon emissions by 80% by 2050. Obama wants to auction those permits to industry and take the money raised from auctioning those permits and give it to the government to fund green tech R&D, to help low-income people deal with the higher price of energy, because no matter what kind of cap-and-trade mechanism you install, carbon-based energy over the next decades is going to get more and more expensive.
Let me ask you a final philosophical question. Given the fact that no matter what we do now, no matter what measures are taken, some climatologists are now saying that the North Pole is going to be pretty much gone. Our children will live to see a North Pole which is free of ice, and the planet Earth itself will look different from outer space, different coastlines, different levels of sea level, so on and so forth, over the decades. So the question is it too little too late, or are you still optimistic?
Well, I'm still optimistic because I think we have no choice but to, you know, go forth and do as much as we can to mitigate the effects of global warming. I don't think we'll be able to escape all the effects of global warming. But if we do nothing, I think those effects will be much more dramatic and much worse. I'd like to see an age where my children are living in a world where the effects of global warming, whether it's more droughts, more torrential rains, more hurricanes, more flooding, rising sea levels, a world where that's a manageable problem as opposed to a catastrophic problem. So I think anything we can do, anything the government can do, anything that industry can do to move our economies towards clean energy can only help.
And any parting thoughts for those people who may want to pick up a copy of your book, The Plot to Save the Planet, How Visionary Entrepreneurs and Corporate Titans Are Creating Real Solutions to Global Warming?
Well, I just like to say to people, you know, have hope. There's tremendous amount of activity in the green tech arena. The best brains in Silicon Valley are applying themselves to solving this problem. There's more money than ever going into solving these problems. I think the biggest challenge, I think the private sector is already well on its way. I think the biggest challenge is political. I think it's a matter of being able to support politicians who can tell us the truth about what's going on and then explain to us what needs to be done. I think that's the message I'd really like to get across. The technology is there. The business know-how is there. The capital is there. But what we need is the political leadership to hasten the adoption of this clean technology.
And that concludes the interview with Mr. Brian Domain of Fortune magazine, and he's the author of a new book called The Plot to Save the Planet, How Visionary Entrepreneurs and Corporate Titans Are Creating Real Solutions to Global Warming. Now, in the last minute of exploration, I'd like to make the following comment. Some people may say, well, we don't trust them. I mean, after all, corporate America perhaps is the problem. We've seen so much foot-dragging. And these corporate titans have to be dragged kicking and screaming to even come to the conference table to talk about restricting global warming gases. And so some environmentalists would say, well, we simply don't trust them. Well, my personal attitude is the situation is so dire that perhaps we have to have not only just an energy mix concerning our energy future, But also we have to bring in organizations, entrepreneurs, and even businessmen who may have part of the solution rather than being part of the problem. We can't be too picky in these times because we do face the possibility of ecological disaster itself. And as a consequence, my own personal attitude is you have to keep the heat on. You have to make sure that all parties are honest in terms of bringing something to the table. But in these times, I think we have to allow for the fact that we have to open the gates in terms of who really is part of the problem and who really is part of the solution.
Now, some of my colleagues in the scientific community think that technical fixes could get us out of the problem. For example, if only we could increase the efficiency of solar cells. If only we can shoot rockets into the atmosphere carrying pollutants which can gradually cool the surface temperature by reflecting light into outer space. If only we can create a new breed of genetically altered organisms which can consume large amounts of carbon dioxide. Well, yes, we should explore technical fixes, but I don't think we should rely upon them. Time is simply not there in order to experiment fully with all these technical fixes, and for each fix, there are also unforeseen side effects. What happens if we pollute the upper atmosphere in order to reflect sunlight back into outer space? That could cool down the planet, but that could also have other deleterious effects on the Earth because, of course, this is shooting pollution into the atmosphere. And yes, we could also create new microorganisms which can absorb more carbon dioxide, but you cannot recall a life form. Once a life form is released into the environment, it's out there for keeps. And who knows what kinds of boomerang effects there could be. So in other words, I think we should also pursue technical fixes as well, but hey, let's not rely upon them.
So that's why I say, let's listen. Let's listen to the voices of all points of view, and then from that perspective, let's make a decision as to which way forward for the planet.
The problem, in other words, is that we are running out of time. The clock is ticking, and it's only a matter of time before we reach different points of no return. I don't think that we've reached the point of no return for the entire planet. However, I think we have passed the point of no return with regards to the North Polar ice caps. Personally, I think that no matter what we do today, it looks as if the North Polar ice caps are going to be gone. Let's just face it. Let's get used to that fact. However, there are other milestones. There are other points of no return that we are gradually approaching. So there is still some time if we act now. And that's why we have to not rely on technical fixes, not rely on platitudes, but on real concrete policies.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest today was Brian Dumain of Fortune Magazine. The book is called The Plot to Save the Planet, How Visionary Entrepreneurs and Corporate Titans Are Creating Real Solutions to Global Warming. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Well, once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on technology. Check out my website. It's mkaku.org, mkaku.org, and my latest book is called Physics of the Impossible.